a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Senator Kevin Cramer with us. I'll talk about it a momentous day with what we know out of Iran. Are you in any way surprised about this, Senator Cramer?
I'm not even a little bit surprised. What I'm surprised by is that the Iranian regime never came to his senses and didn't take Donald Trump's threats seriously. He's given them so many opportunities to come to the table to discuss a deal, to reduce their ambitions related to nuclear weapon systems, and they thumbed their nose at him. So that if anything surprises me, it's that they never came to their senses and realized that this is a major flaw in their character, and they have lots of them.
Why do you think they were that adamant that they weren't about to budge on any of the new deals? First of all, there's been new deals in the past that they've not lived up to, so they could have attempted that again. But why are they so welded to this? They don't want to make a deal. They obviously have some plans in the works related to the use of those. Am I wrong?
Mm-hmm. No, that's a great point. I think in a nutshell, the reason for it, Scott, is theology. We are familiar with Islam. We're familiar with radical Islam. But then there's what your friend Lindsey Graham refers to the Iranians as religious Nazis. And so I think it's hard almost to wrap your mind around a doctrine that's so deep and so rich that they'd rather die than live. And sometimes that gets tested, and the leader of a radical Islamic group demonstrates that he believes it's better to die than live, but he imposes it on his followers rather than himself. It may very well be in the case of the Ayatollah, who, as you know, is a very elderly man and has a tremendous religious power over the regime, that maybe he really would rather die than live. And if that's the case, it's hard to win a war against somebody who thinks dying is the only thing better than living is dying. And that their rewards, of course, are greater if they're a martyr. So I think that's a little bit of it, Scott. I think you're just dealing with such a radical religious depth and of evil religious depth that there was no way that they could ever come to our position.
Is this another example of President Trump transforming the world?
Well, I think it's the most transforming geopolitical move in my lifetime. I can't think of another moment when a president of the United States or a leader from anywhere in the world changes the foundation, if you will. And it's huge for this for so many reasons, because remember, he has set this up not just by moving entire military operations practically to the Middle East and into the Gulf region. He has done this first by setting up friendships and alliances with the Arab world, whether it's Saudi Arabia, the UAE, certainly Jordan. You've seen this, the Qatar. I mean, you've seen this movement from enemy to frenemy and then into more of a normal relations, brokering deals between Israel and peaceful Arab nations. And when I say peaceful, I mean it's not like they're Great Britain, but they're nations whose leaders have determined that I'd rather be part of that club than the club I'm in. That they'd rather enjoy the fruits and benefits of trade and open relationships. And you have to respect that, Scott. And so he set this up that way. And remember, one of the things going into today, into this morning's epic fury, is that these nations, first, they urge the United States openly and publicly not to do what we're doing. And now they're in the fight because Iran retaliated not just against the United States and Israel, but they're retaliating against them being Saudi Arabia, UAE, and other Arab allies. So what they're doing is they're pushing their frenemies right into our arms. And again, you know, there's a lot of posturing and whatnot that goes on in a situation like this. So, you know, you sort of have to weigh your risks and rewards carefully. And they've done that. And they've concluded that these frenemies are, in fact, their enemies. And I just think this repositions the entire Middle East. Now, it's not over. Obviously, this is not going to happen in a matter of hours or days. This is going to take a long time, and it's going to require our friends, the citizens of Iran, you know, to pick up some of the pieces, and they seem to be prepared and willing to do exactly that. So we'll see. But it also is going to, I think, it's going to require Scott other allies. Remember, one of the worst has been the United Kingdom in this. That Sturmer guy is goofier than a $3 bill. And he has not been very supportive. He's spoken out worse against the United States in some of this than, you know, than the leaders in some of the Arab countries. So they're going to have to dig themselves out of a little bit of a hole. But I was very pleased with Prime Minister Carney from Canada's statement today. Strong support for the United States. Strong support for the action. And as I put out in my tweet of retweeting his ex. I imagine we can count on Canada to come to the fight with us when the time is right.
Yeah, you're calling the question for sure with the folks that have said the right things, but will they do the right thing? You know, I think we as a country have a very short memory related to the things Iran has done, and for that matter, on anything. And there'll be a lot of people saying, "Oh my gosh, we're at war with Iran." You know. Why is this necessary? Why? I mean, just refresh our memories on what Iran has done, I mean, to our troops, even, and freedom-loving people around the world.
Scott, that's such an important question, and you're right to bring it up. And it's important that we bring it up regularly because our memories are so short. Because, you know, we run into isolationists all the time, and most of them are in the Republican Party, or at least they align themselves with the Republican Party, and they live in a bubble of information as well as, you know, to philosophy. Iran is an aggressor. That's the thing. Iran isn't just a sleepy little village in the Sahara, or in Africa. Iran is a major power. It's 90 million people. It's one of the largest countries of oppressed people in the world, and they're wealthy. They now we've challenged that wealth a lot lately, and thank you again, President Trump, for actually exercising sanctions on Iran's oil and remembering that Iran sold a lot of its oil to China, and so you had two enemies helping each other. And by the way, this move is going to separate a lot of that as well. A lot of their quote friendships with other rogue nations like China, but they're an aggressor, and that's why we can never let them have a nuclear weapon. It's why when Barack Obama made a deal, just imagine this: Barack Obama, not very many presidents ago, made a deal with Iran called the Iranian nuclear deal. You might recall. Without congressional approval, by the way, and that actually sanctioned Iran's right to have to advance their nuclear capabilities, you know, under quote inspections, you know, by the United Nations. It was insane. And thank goodness Donald Trump came along and tore it up. Because that level of weakness was, in fact, they'd be well within the actual deal probably about now had we allowed that deal to stand. So anyway, they're an aggressor. They're the number one state sponsor of terror in the world. Whether it's Houthis, Hezbollah, Hamas, they've got all kinds of proxies, and they have stated with great conviction their intent to wipe out the United States of America and Israel. And you know, we've taken the position in previous eras, Scott. That's not our problem. That's over there. World War One, good example. United States stayed out of it for a long time. They started sinking ships. Pretty soon they're sinking American ships, and then Americans are dying. And then we get involved in the war. World War Two. Well, that's not our problem. Note that, you know, Mr. Prime Minister Churchill, we'd love to help, but you know, there's nothing we can do. That's your problem. And then suddenly, you know, they attack us in a surprise attack at Pearl Harbor. They being in that case the Japanese, So the United States gets involved, and I don't know when we're gonna have a population that has a long enough memory or is interested enough in history to realize that we're a lot of other countries' enemies because we're free, and that comes a tremendous amount of responsibility to protect our own homeland as well as protect the world. And I'd much rather fight an enemy on their turf than them fighting us on ours.
Yeah, I'd love to see a line by line list of the Americans they've taken out and the bases they've attacked. I think if people understand that, you'd say, well, this can't continue. And unfortunately, it has continued from administration until now. How will we judge victory in Iran right now? What will be the benchmark here to say we won?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I would start with, I'd go back to Midnight Hammer, obliterating their nuclear arsenals. I think there's a bit more to be done, and that's what's happening now. I think that's target number one, is to make sure that they don't have, never get nuclear weapons, but then to attack their arsenal that facilitates that. And they have a good one. I mean, they're ground-to-ground missiles, they're ballistic missiles, mid-range missiles that can reach American bases and American allies, to include Israel. The fact that they share, by the way, another important point, the fact that they share that technology and those weapons with other adversaries like Russia, for example, pretty significant. So when our really bad adversaries become allies with each other, that compounds our problem. So I think part of it is to completely dismantle their capability to fight at all, to include, by the way, a Navy. And let's not forget that the Houthis attacked and killed, in some cases, American military, and in other cases, severely wounded, including a warrant officer from North Dakota. And they did it with Iranian support, obviously, Iranian technologies, and they were doing it with intelligence from an Iranian intelligence ship that Joe Biden let do it. He let that ship out there, let them put targets on our military men and women. The only thing we did is we intercepted those, as many of those missiles and weapons and drones as we could. And we were intercepting, $10,000 drones with $10 million missiles. I mean, it was the dumbest strategy in the history of the world. And we should have taken that ship out of the Red Sea and put it at the bottom of the Red Sea, and Joe Biden would not do it. And that empowered them. So that's just one example of the aggression against the United States, led by Iran, perpetrated by their proxies with their full support. And so anyway, we can take out their Navy. That will be another layer of the victory. But the ultimate victory will be a regime change, even though that's not our stated goal. I believe that would be the biggest victories if the freedom-loving people of Iran, who are, as you know, Scott, because you know Iranians that live in the United States, that live in North Dakota, that live in Fargo, they participate in our institutions, our universities. I've met a group of I call them Iranian friends and neighbors, at Microsoft early on in my career, right there in Fargo. They're contributors. They're some of the most patriotic non-American Americans you'll ever meet. If they take back their own country, we could have an ally and friend in the Middle East that would be, well, it would ensure stability for a very long time, if not forever.
And ultimately giving those people the freedom they've sought for far too long and been ignored, I assume they're the ones ultimately they're going to do regime change, right? I mean, this isn't boots on the ground of the U.S. Yeah. Toppling a government other than softening up those targets, removing their hard assets. But this is about those people that are on the streets right now pleading for freedom, right? I mean, they're the ones that would do regime change, am I right?
They are, but let's not forget that one of the major pleas that the president made in his 8-minute video, which I encourage everybody to go back and watch, because he really states it so well, of course. He calls on the Iranian military itself to join us. And I think that when you ask for, you know, how do we know we succeeded? What's success look like? That is would be one of them, is that if enough of their own military would turn on them, because then you have what you need even to change a regime. In other words, what you don't want to do and what you can't expect the people in the streets of Iran to do is take on a military. We're going to airdrop military grade weapon systems for citizens to take up arms. There may be ways to get that kind of help, but it's got to start with somebody in military leadership. Now, interestingly, Iran has basically two layers of military. They have what we often hear about, the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. And then they have, and they're what the IRGC is, of course, they really function as the politically loyal sort of super funded ideological army. So you know, that's their main fighting force, if you will, when it comes to protecting the regime's politics. But the Artish, they're the conventional territorial defenders. They protect the borders. And they're more likely to flip sooner because they're not run by or share the ideological theology, if you will, of the leadership or the regime. So I think a big part of getting to success and victory and regime change starts with the military itself, because short of that happening, then you are talking about boots on the ground. The United States, I don't believe, and I certainly don't think Donald Trump is ever going to put American soldiers or even special operators on the ground. It could happen, but I have serious doubts about that. But Israel certainly would. And so, and particularly if we end up with help from, you know, from other Arab states, you could see something like that happening, because clearly the people need to have some firepower behind them.
The easiest path to getting to the definition of success would be the Iranian military saying, I now have the freedom not to be part of that regime and ultimately be part of the solution. That's the easiest path there, isn't it?
That would be the easiest. It would be obviously very, very helpful. And I think we can expect some of that. I really do. There's a strong will of, I believe, a vast majority of the people, from every bit of intelligence we have, the vast majority of the people would rather be free of this regime than part of it. And whether the military follows the people or the people follow the military, as long as they're all working against the regime, I think they'll be hugely successful.
Another historic day in a little better than a year's of the administration. To me, if you took a breath and stepped back and looked at things week by week, it's astonishing what this administration has taken on, isn't it?
It's really quite remarkable. In fact, sometimes I think, you know, I just want to say, slow down. I'm getting dizzy, Mr. President. But there are big things to get done, Scott. Really big things. And this president is committed to doing them. And he does them in an unconventional way. Well, in some respects, by doing them, he's unconventional. Because presidents for so long have talked about big things. You know how many presidents, Republicans especially, over the decades have talked about doing what Donald Trump is doing today? How many of them have talked about stabilizing the Western Hemisphere, talked about stabilizing the Southern the Southern Hemisphere, talked about energy dominance, have talked about getting our fiscal matters in check in the United States. How many of them have talked about lower taxes and growing the economy and diminishing the trade deficit and all of these things that presidents talk about? This president does day to day to day to day to day. And while he's never going to get a single good word in the Fargo Forum that you don't write, Scott, this president deserves a ton of credit for accomplishing the things that none of his predecessors could do. They just talked about.